Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is getaways. We'll hear stories of going undercover, finding paradise, and getting the hell out of Dodge. All the stories for this show were originally told in March 2014 at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage as part of our live Arctic Entries event.
Like this story from ex-Czechoslovakian Jardo Varosicki.
And then we were trying to find somebody to trade us for the motorcycle that we had to be able to get to boat ride to Italy. And all these different characters that we run into, we kind of got scared. You know, we were 18 years old, you don't know much. So we end up deciding that we're going to swim.
But first, we'll start this episode of the Arctic Entries Radio Hour with a song from local musician and Arctic Entries storyboard member Carlisle Watt. You may know Carlisle from his band, the Supersaturated Sugar Strings, which also created the Arctic Entries theme song.
Oh, I know that you want me. Honey, you know you can't have me. That spot on your finger is lonely. It wants a friend. And you know that I want you just as soon as I can't have you. For the loneliest hearts, they lie in jealous men. Oh yes, I am such a man, but jealous as I am, those games you play, they are getting on my last nerve. What it boils down to is me and you and a couple lonely hearts that we don't deserve. We are nothing but fools, about as sharp as rusty tools. You know and I know what we're feeling inside. So let's lay it on the table tonight. It is clean, and in your eyes there's a gleam. Lay down your terms, and I'll give you my offer if it's right. Yes, that look in your eyes says nothing certain but death and taxes. So come on, we're feeling strong. Tag along, we'll sing a song tonight. Ooh, we got this love thing in the bag. Honey, I don't give a brag, but the feeling will last till I am gray hair. So you just take it from me. Honey, I don't wanna be free. You're the man who thought he was loving impaired. We are nothing but fools, about as sharp as rusty tools. You know, I know what we're feeling inside. So let's lay it on the table tonight.
That was Carlisle Watt, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA, Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme for this show is getaways.
Amy Mack is an adventurous vagabond, and she's met a lot of interesting characters along the way. But she'd like to tell us about one character in particular. Here's Amy Mack sharing a story about her adventures with a guy named John.
I picked up a hitchhiker on my very first journey to Mount Baker ski area. He had a snowboard in hand, so it seemed like a natural choice to pull over. That was 1997. John and I became very good friends very fast. He intrigued me and infuriated me all at the same time. This guy was a hardcore vegan, rippin' snowboarder, wannabe rapper with a lady killer smile and a sexy body all wrapped up into one arrogant and erratic persona that made most people want to punch him in the face. Most women thought about exercising that option, but they also would think about exercising with him in another way. I simply was happy to have a friend who challenged my skills on the mountain and showed me all the best places to ride, eat, and drink. John, he was the thriftiest guy I ever met, so he gave me lengthy tours of all of the best shops in Bellingham. We spent hours driving back and forth from the hippie natural food markets to the discount stores that shelved all those dented cans that the hippie food stores had rejected, comparing prices and making very wise decisions. He was my better half, he was my other half for the better part of 3 years. We spent a lot of time on the mountain together and basically never crossed that friend line. But I'm not saying I didn't think about it. Suddenly, in the spring of 2000, an opportunity arose for me in Alaska, and John decided to come with me. We drove up here and lived in the back of my truck, literally down by the river, until we landed a not-so-sweet gig in a trailer in Healy, surrounded by sled dogs that we came to realize were malnourished and abused. We had brought our dog Leroy with us, and that made it even harder to see. John really struggled. He didn't connect with people very naturally, and the lack of discounted soy milk in Healy was really hard for him. So he had to split and went back to Bellingham. And we kept in touch over the years, and from time to time, when we could, we would visit each other. We dabbled in expressing our feelings towards each other one night by candlelight in his cabin loft on the Mount Baker Highway, where we wrote a poem together, written in free verse, hip-hop style. We took turns going from line to line spontaneously. I analyzed that poem for years. I thought he was trying to tell me something. I wanted to kiss him so bad that night, but settled for spooning. In the morning, he pissed me off because he gave me a hard time for how many toilet paper squares I used when I went to the bathroom. Here's where I started to realize he might have some bigger mental problems than I was really aware of. John traveled to Costa Rica, and I luxuriated in his tales of that trip. In 2003, he decided to go back and invited me to go with him. Just us, Costa Rica bound. Our paradise awaited. We made our way to Puerto Jimenez on the Osa Peninsula and located Escondido Treks, where we were going to be volunteering for a while in exchange for a place to stay. The first obstacle was immediate. Our benefactor was unavailable due to a medical issue and was hours away in surgery. We waited around and found out eventually that we had permission to move into his beach house and begin our work and training. The deal was 2 solid weeks of volunteer work, clearing trail in his jungle campground and fruit tree farm, and then we could begin training to be kayak guides. So a normal day started to consist of wielding machetes and dealing with deadly snakes, bats, poisonous insects, parasites, poverty, sweat-stained clothes. There was also a healthy dose of exotic birds, amazing rum, grapefruit, ocean sunrises and sunsets, and we were on to our beautiful adventure. Our leader at the time was a gringo named Joe, who had married a Tika and lived nearby. He'd come over some nights and sit on our porch drinking beer and talking, and one time he brought his dog with him. She made her way around the circle of people, sniffing each person. When she got to John, she quickly laid at his feet, submissively and super calm. A few seconds later, with absolutely no warning, she jumped up, spun around aggressively with a snarl, leapt at his face, and bit his lip, puncturing it to a point where it pulled away from his face. Then, just like before, quickly laid down at his feet, super calm, and acted like nothing had happened. He bled a lot. He had to be taken away to the local doctor to be sewn up and was given orders not to let sun, dirt, or sweat hit his face for weeks to come, so his volunteer days in the jungle were over. If I failed to mention before, John was extremely vain. In the days to come, I kept working and he kept drinking. He got up to a bottle of rum a day. And he became a person that I just didn't know very well anymore. And he proved that one day when he pulled a knife on another guide and threatened him. I never could figure out what lit his fuse. All I know is that I pleaded with him to calm down and realize that he didn't have any enemies and there was no battle to be fought. After that moment, I couldn't relate to him anymore. He had morphed into a violent and angry person that was on an emotional island all his own. The Fertilance, a really deadly snake, showed up at the back door of John's bedroom the day that his face was bit. And the omens just kept coming. Even the jungle creatures were trying to tell me that being near this man, my best friend, was a really dangerous place to be. Our boss was still in the hospital, and the rest of the guides and I decided that we needed to let him know that we were in a situation that was becoming more and more surreal and hostile by the day. We gave him a call, and he had a plan. He had an idea. He said, you know, what we're going to do is you're going to all tell John that the operation's being shut down because of my injury. And we're going to wait for him to leave, and you guys are going to go into hiding. And when he leaves, you're going to come back, and we're going to start this thing all over again. It worked. In a really sad and emotional goodbye that consisted mostly of me crying while being shown the middle finger, John and I parted ways. I went into hiding for a few days on a remote beach and tried to gather the courage to continue my journey alone. After I knew that he had left on a water taxi, I came back to the beach house and started my real journey in Costa Rica. I learned all about the birds and the plants and the flowers. I took a bunch of tourists by kayak on mangrove tours, sunset and dolphin watching tours, had visits three or four times a day by monkeys and various species of monkeys, had a few boyfriends, got really fit and strong, and eventually fell in love with myself. I never heard from John again. 5 months later, I returned to Alaska and told my friends the story. I got really curious about him from time to time, but no Google or Facebook search ever gave any results. And then 1 year, 8 years later actually, a friend of mine had an unfortunate mishap with some keys that were lost or misplaced in Joshua Tree National Park and had to hitch a ride from a park ranger, who she started trading small talk with. The usual pleasantries ensued to the point where he said, oh, I used to have a friend that lived in Anchorage. She worked at a place that was the bear or the moose something or other. They talked about a few other things, snowboarding, Mount Baker, and a dog named Leroy. My friend looked down and noticed that he had a holster with a gun attached to his belt, and she asked him, is your name John?
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSK Anchorage. This hour, our theme is getaways, and that was Amy Mack. If you run into her at Beartooth, make sure to ask about her adventures with John.
Now here's a story from Spinard's Eileen Cole. Eileen grew up in Fairbanks, and like many Alaskans, she has some great road trip stories. Here's Eileen, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in March 2014.
So my mom has seven older brothers, Dave, Don, Dennis, Duncan, Dale, Daryl, and she's Dwight, and she is Debbie. In the summer of 1994, my uncle Dwight was getting married. And this is a family that values efficiency. I mean, for God's sake, all of their initials are DC. In addition to the wedding, the day before, we were going to have an intervention for another uncle the day before. I'm sure they figured, you know, what the hell, let's just make it a twofer. And so my parents are the kind of people that when I was a kid, the first time I ever flew on an airplane, they made me sit down and watch this two-hour instructional video on how to conduct yourself on an airplane. So it's pretty safe to describe them as pretty methodical and organized, at least my mom, and well thought out. And despite their best attempts to plan out a road trip from Fairbanks, where I'm from, down to eastern Washington, where the wedding and the intervention were going to be held, while some of it went according to plan, other parts of it did not go according to plan. So we left sometime in late July. I forgot to mention I was six at the time. We left sometime in late July, and the first day we made it to Delta Junction. And for those of you who don't know interior geography, that is 2 hours from Fairbanks. day one, we were already behind schedule. Day two, we're driving and we're on our way to Toke, and I had staked out the back seat, so I was sitting back there playing Mad Libs. And when I was a kid and I played Mad Libs, probably like the rest of the young people in here, I used shut up and dumb as in all the blanks. And so that's what I was doing. And my mom looks in the rearview mirror and I'm scratching my head. So we stop, she gets out. And much to her complete horror, I have head lice. And not only do I have head lice, but my siblings have head lice, and we have graciously given it to my mother. The only person somehow remaining immune was my dad. For those of you who are fortunate enough not to know how you treat head lice, it really helps if you have running water. And because we were camping, we didn't. So we stopped at the first place that had running water, which was the Toke laundromat. So we go to the store, get this treatment, and it's horrible. You sit down for about an hour, it coats your head like shampoo. So I sat there sobbing with this thing on my head, with my siblings doing the same. So we were treated, and I spent the next 10 hours in the Toke laundromat playing Game Boy while my parents washed 3 weeks worth of clothes for 5 people, all of our gear, and the inside of our car. Yeah, for those of you who haven't spent time in the Toke laundromat, it's nice. So then we spent some time there. We were on our way. Next day or two, we're in Canada. Turns out the treatment didn't work. So we go to another pharmacy, and we get this other stuff to treat your hair, and it's different because it's twice as strong, because there's an ingredient that we found out later was not FDA approved. So it worked, but despite that, it turns your hair into like a Brillo pad, but I was 6, I didn't really care. And so that was all good. We drive for another day or so. That's uneventful compared to the rest. We stop at this place. For those of you who know what Muckluck Annie's is, it's a diner. And it was eventful for me for several reasons, but we were camping, so most of the time we were just cooking food in the campground or whatever. So we stop at this diner, this buffet, and the best part about a buffet when you're a small person is that you have complete autonomy. Yeah, that baby knows what I'm talking about. You have complete autonomy over what food you eat, because you're 6. So my brother and I, who was 9, walk into the diner, and there's this big, long buffet. And at the end, there's a vat of bacon. And it was gleaming like an angel from afar. So we grabbed our plates, bypassed the rest of the line, and just started filling up on bacon. And, you know, I was 6, my stomach is probably like the size of a grapefruit, but I ate a whole plate of bacon. Then I went up and got another one. My brother did the same. And so we sat, while the rest of my family ate normal food, we sat, we finished, we got in the car, the brief time of short but violent bout of sickness from both of us. That was all great. So we drive another day or two. We get to Eastern Washington, eventually our destination. You know, there's the wedding. It's all fine. It's worked. They're still married. The intervention didn't work. He's still an alcoholic. And that's all fine and great. And so we spend a couple days there. And we then depart, armed with the knowledge that nothing could possibly be as bad as 10 hours in the Toke laundromat. So it was a good thing that when the transmission in the van blew out, we were in a town with a phone, so my parents could call the newsminder where they were working and let them know that they would be, in fact, spending an extra week on their vacation with their lovely children. So, you know, we spent about a week there hiking and swimming, and it was really great and actually was the highlight of the trip for me and probably my parents, it was nice. And we eventually made it home after a couple more days, looking back on that trip, you know, as an adult now, I think of, you know, when I think of the trip, initially what first comes to mind is, well, that trip's the reason why I didn't eat bacon for an entire decade. But also, first and foremost, the trip will be the trip from hell. So, thank you.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSK Anchorage. This hour, our theme is getaways, and that was Eileen Cole.
At each live Arctic Entries event, storytellers have 7 minutes to share a story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of the live Arctic Entries show let the storytellers know it's almost time to wrap things up. And then another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Next, we'll hear from Kaylin Emanuel. Originally from Connecticut, Kaylin is a nomadic nurse with lots of stories. But here, she has one that fits perfectly with the going undercover take on our theme.
So it's September 2006. It's about 9 o'clock at night on a Thursday, and I am fervently studying for this pathophysiology exam the next morning when my phone rings. And I don't want to answer it, but I see it's my friend Mitch, who is my buddy. He's my partner in crime and my comic relief in this insane, intense nurse practitioner program we are both enrolled in. So I answer it thinking it's going to be about the exam. But no, it has nothing to do about the exam. He starts going on and on about this bachelor party he's planning for his friend Oliver. And he and his friend Joel are planning it, and yada, yada. So finally, I cut him off, and I say, Mitch, no offense, buddy, but why do I give a shit about your friend's bachelor party? And he's like, well, Kaylin, here's the thing. Oliver's really adamant about no strippers at the party. And, you know, he doesn't believe in it. He thinks it's degrading to women. He just, no strippers, no matter what. But, you know, Joel and I are planning the party, and we gotta mess with him, and we need a fake stripper. So obviously you're the first person that came to mind. So I'm like, thank you? So I'm like, what, Mitch, no, I'm not taking my clothes off for your friend, let alone when you're there, absolutely not. He's like, no, Kaylin, fake stripper, fake. You're not really gonna take your clothes off. Mitch, I don't even have boobs. I'm not built like a stripper. I don't exotic. No, how could I pull this off? He's like, Kaylin, please. Okay, number one, plenty of strippers don't have boobs. Number two, Oliver doesn't go to strip clubs. He won't know the difference anyway. It doesn't matter. He's like, you're going to be great. And anyway, Kaylin, you're the only chick I know that has the balls to do something like this. And I say, yeah, good point. Good call. Yeah, I'm in. Wait. His fiance, Maya, I don't know. Oh, no, Kaylin, she's totally in on it. She thinks it's hilarious. She totally supports this. She's in on the joke, which, by the way, was true. So I'm like, all right, yeah, I'm in. Let's do it. Okay, so what's the plan? Yeah. So Joel and I just, you know, we needed to have you on board first, and then we figured we would come up with something. Okay, when's the bachelor party? Next weekend. Oh, Jesus. Okay. So we meet. Joel, Mitch, and I, we meet up, and we get to planning over a few drinks. And believe it or not, it is difficult to plan to be a fake stripper. There's a lot of logistics involved, like how are we gonna pull this off? How's it gonna be a joke? How's he gonna buy it? But fear not, we came up with an awesome plan. It was so ridiculous, so over the top, probably the result of the amount of drinks we had that night. But we figured, yes, this is awesome. It's flawless. We're gonna nail it. So over the next week, I routinely practice with my Carmen Electra lap dance workout DVD, which, number one, yes, I own. And number two, ladies, is an awesome ab workout. So I get my routine down. I'm like, gonna nail it. And Saturday comes, and I show up at the location, which is Keen Steakhouse. Now, for those of you who may or may not know, Keen Steakhouse in New York City is one of the oldest and finest establishments in New York City. It was once a men's-only club in the 18 and early 1900s. Its members include Teddy Roosevelt, Albert Einstein, and General George MacArthur. Yeah, you like that? So, it has mahogany wood paneled walls, velvet clad chairs, fine oil paintings on the walls. You have to wear a jacket. We're talking classy, upscale joint, clearly the place for a fake stripper, right? So, as planned, now, I wish I could tell you more about my friend Mitch, but Mitch and his friends have a great sense of humor, and for Oliver's bachelor party, they've decided to make a mockery of this. So they have rented out one of the banquet rooms. I believe it was the Moose Bull Room, which had a big taxidermied moose on the wall. And they, again, as a mockery, are all wearing suits, ascots, and fezzes, and they have dressed Oliver in this ridiculous tuxedo and put him up in this little makeshift stage where they're roasting him. The poor guy has 20 of his good friends, including his father and father-in-law, roasting him for his bachelor party. So anyway, I go outside of the private room, little bathroom, and I get changed into my outfit, and I'm outside the room waiting for my cue. And I'm squatting there waiting, nervous. And I look over, and I see one of the waiters is kind of giving me this look up and down, disgusted look. And I look down at myself, and I realize I'm standing in the middle of the dining room of Keen Steakhouse wearing high heels, red fishnet stockings, short booty shorts, this low-cut blazer with my best push-up bra ever. And I had this long, curly blonde hair at the time. It's all piled up in my head. And I have my fake librarian glasses on and fuzzy handcuffs sticking out of those booty shorts. And I look over and I say, oh, I'm not really a stripper. I'm like an undercover stripper. It's a prank. It's a joke for my friend Oliver. It's just a joke. I'm not really a stripper. And he says, yeah. I say, well, I'm in nurse practitioner school at Columbia University. I am not a real student. You know what? Forget it. And I'm like, screw you. So I listen for my cue, and I hear it. Joel says, so Oliver, buddy, we're really sorry. We know you didn't want strippers at your bachelor party, but you left Mitch and I in charge of the planning. So without further ado, we give you Mitch. What's her name? And Mitch says, Candy. Cue up the music. And my red fishnet stockinged leg goes around the door, a little up and down. And I start strutting my stuff in, just like Carmen Electra taught me. And aside from the fezzes and the ascots, and poor Oliver, with his bright red face and his ridiculous tuxedo, I see next to Oliver this giant cutout of his face. They've taken a picture of Oliver and blown it up on this huge poster board, cut out like his face, and it's mounted right next to him on this stage. So I'm trying to keep a straight face as a fake stripper, right? And so I'm like, okay, I can do this. And I do my little dance, and I get up in front of him and start doing my lap dance without touching him. And I say, hey, Oliver, I hear you like to get kinky. And he says, no. And he's being so, so polite to me and gracious, because that's the kind of guy Oliver is, and shooting daggers at Mitch and Joel. And I say, oh, well, that's not what I heard. So, and all the guys are in on the joke, so they're cheering me on. And I go over to Joel, and I take off his ascot as planned, and I come back over to Oliver, and I say, let's get kinky. And blindfold him, take those handcuffs out, handcuff him around the chair, get behind it. Joel pulls up a chair. I climb up behind him on top of it and say, "How would you like a golden shower?" He says, no, thank you. No, definitely not. No. And Joel hands me the bottle of water, of warm water, and I start pouring it over his head. He jumps up, gets out of those fake handcuffs, gets the blindfold off. What the? We're all dying. I compose myself and take off those fake glasses and say, I'm not Candy. Hi, Oliver. My name is Kaylin. I go to nursing school with Mitch.
That was Kaylin Emanuel, live at Arctic Entries in March 2014. For those just tuning in, our theme for this show is Getaways. These are stories of going undercover, finding paradise, and getting the hell out of Dodge.
At each live event, we feature music from a local artist. Here's another song from Carlisle Walk.
For many more years than I can count, the land did provide. Where men and trees lived side by side, men and trees did die. They took no more than they could use, so the mountain did abide. They lived in peace with the natural flow, so the spirit wouldn't die. The white man settled on the great blue ridge, and they learned nice and quick. If they pillaged to make a dime, their new landlord would evict. So it went for many a year, this law between nature and land. As the story usually goes, greed overtook the land. See, before the rain stood where it lies, it was an equatorial delight. Ferns and palms grew like weeds, and their death would change them outright. Time and pressure turned peat to lignite, heat turned that to coal. An energy source that could fuel the world turned men to sell their souls. First to go were the trees, you know. They stood for millions of years. Oaks and hemlocks, maples and birch, pines, Fraser firs. The logging companies, they cleared them all with no prejudice, it seemed. The sun dried up the soil, rain washed away fertility. Miners came and dug their coal, and the man, he was thrilled. They started fires that roared the land, but their pockets was getting filled. And many a man lost his life in the mines of the great Blue Ridge. Oh, the rich man shed not a single tear, not a quiver, nor a smidge. What's done is done, I reckon so. We'll never know the truth. What the mountains can be today, they've been plucked of their fruit. The men who done these awful deeds got no soul that I can tell. But all these bastards are having a ball, clear cutting the lands of hell. Now it's one thing to sing about it, another thing to act. To use no more than we really need, who here cannot cut back. We got to learn from our past about what's right and what's a mistake. oil rigs in our oceans, and a copper mine in Bristol Bay.
Thanks Carlisle Watt for the music. More about him and his band at supersaturatedsugarstrings.com. You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. And now it's time to hear more true stories from Alaskans.
Issa Brahman is a history enthusiast who wants to see everything. She told her story live at Arctic Entries in March 2014 at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I've loved history my entire life. Last summer, my friend said, let's go to Hawaii, it'll be great, we're going to go to the beach, and I said, ugh, I don't want to do that, I don't care about Hawaii, I don't want to go on the beach. And then I thought about it, and I thought, that's where Pearl Harbor is, we're going. And my immediate reaction whenever I see something historical is immediate tears. It's like, it can't stop. And this love for history, this intrigue about all these things I care so much about, led me to Germany in 2009. When I got to Germany in 2009, I thought, all right, I'm going to have my great adventure. I'm going to see all these things I've loved so much. I'm going to see everything, and I can't wait. And then it hit me. Oh, my God. It's been 65 years since June 6, 1944. And everyone in the audience right now who's good at world history knows that June 6, 1944 is what? The most important epic battle of World War II of all time. It's D-Day. It's the invasion of the beaches of Normandy. And I knew in my heart and in my soul I had to be there. I was going to storm the beaches on the 65th anniversary, and I was going to do it. But I knew I had to be smart, and I had to be prepared. So I figured out what the best city to go to, Caen. I'm going to make reservations. I'm going to go to Caen. And I thought about my secret weapon, which was my girlfriend that speaks French. So we make all these plans, and we're getting ready to go, and we take off in June, in early June, and we go to the area of Normandy. And we go to the first place called Mount St. Michel, which I didn't want to go to. It's a monastery. But my girlfriend really wanted to go. And then we get there, and it's everything I already hoped it was going to be. There's American soldiers, there's British soldiers, there's French soldiers, there's German soldiers, there's tanks. And they're talking about 65 years later, look at how far we've gotten, and I can't stand it. Oh, it feels so good. I'm here. And then to make it better, I meet two American soldiers who tell me that they're going to paratroop out of the sky at 11 a.m. on June 6th and land on the beaches. I thought, this is it. I've done it. And so we take off to Caen on June 5th, and I get into the city of Caen. We get out of the train station. We walk in, and it's weird. Everywhere I look are pictures of President Obama. And I thought, what is the deal with President Obama? There's posters of President Obama. There's T-shirts with President Obama's face on them. There's blackface dolls that are extremely racist, the French are not aware of. In all the shops, everywhere I look is President Obama. And I said to my girlfriend, man, the French really like President Obama. We get to our hotel, and I turn on the news, and everywhere I look is President Obama. I'm so confused because in America, we call them freedom fries. We hate the French so much. But so here we are, and we're watching it. And I finally say, what are they saying? And Jamie says, oh, my God, Issa, President Obama is coming to Caen tomorrow to speak about the 65th anniversary of D-Day. Oh, my God. I'm going to go to the beaches, and I'm going to hang out with Barack Obama. So this is pretty much the best day of my life. We get up at 7 in the morning because I have to get excited. I'm ready. We get on the bus because we're going to go to the train station by train ticket so I can get back to Germany to go back to school. We get on the bus. We get off. We go to the streetcar. The streetcar, there's a sign in French. And I said to Jamie, what does this sign say? She says, the streetcar's closed because of President Obama. Okay, well, let's just walk to the train station. Can't be too bad. Get to the train station. We need tickets for tonight. There's only one train leaving Caen today. It's in 20 minutes. And if you miss that train, then there's no other train out of the city. Jamie looks at me, and I said to her very sincerely, I don't care what happens. We can sleep on the beaches. We're not leaving this place. So let's go. We walk outside, and everywhere I look, I'm surrounded by President Obama, who's just entirely ruined my day at this point. And to keep it even low-key is the fact that there's giant posters that say, yes, we can, all over them. Yeah, that's great, because that's really motivational when I'm at this point in my life. And I'm looking for anybody that can give me an answer about where to go. And so I'm talking to everybody. Jamie's talking to everyone in French. I'm talking to everybody in English. I'm standing next to this Canadian, and he's talking to me, and all of a sudden he's like, yes! Oh my God, I can't believe it! And I'm like, oh, there he is. There's President Obama. I'm going to turn around and see this guy. And so I turn around, and instead of seeing Secret Service agents, I see one motorcycle and a guy hanging out of a car window waving. It's the Canadian Prime Minister. So that guy is just driving down the street with no Secret Service, and we've shut an entire city down for President Obama at this point. I don't really know what to do, and I feel like I'm going to cry, but I'm not giving up. I'm going to get to the beaches, and as I'm trying to get out, there's thousands of French people coming. And so I look at my girlfriend, and I say, please, please just walk over to that police officer. Please try to get an answer from him. She said, okay, I will. So as I stand there, she goes off to the police officer, comes back, and says, well, the police officer said that maybe, quite possibly, I don't know, you could walk, 45 minutes outside of the city, and then maybe, I don't know if the bus is running, but you could possibly, the bus might come, and before there was another maybe, I said, put the backpack on, we're walking, I don't care if it's 45 minutes, I don't care if we gotta walk all the way to the beaches, I'm going to the beaches of Normandy, that's why I came here. So, I'm going to be honest, I did not carry the backpack, I never carried anything when we backpacked through Europe. Jamie put the backpack on, I marched proudly in front of her. We got to the bus stop, and we waited for what seemed like hours. And as I waited for that bus, I thought, it's okay, it's going to come, it's going to come. And the bus came. We get on the bus, and we take off, and I'm going to get to Sword Beach, which isn't the best beach. I don't know if you guys know, Sword Beach is the British beach. It's not where I wanted to go, but at this point, beggars can't be choosers. And so We get to Sword Beach, I immediately get off the bus, I run to the beach, and you know what came, the tears. It was so real. I was standing on this beach that means nothing to anybody else except for the world to me. I'm crying, and now I'm jacked, now I'm like high on the beaches, so I'm like, put the backpack on, we gotta keep walking, we can get to Juno Beach, which is the Canadian beach. We can get there, I can do that. And so we're walking down this street, and as I'm walking, cars are pulling over yelling, America, America, where is Obama? Like because I'm American, that I have President Obama's cell phone number and we just like hang out or something. And no matter what I did, everybody's like, what, where is Obama? And so we finally get to Juno Beach, and I looked at her and I said, you know what? This was maybe the hardest thing that's ever happened to me, but we did it. We're here. I got to see all the American military vets. I talked to some people. I was so happy. There's the War Museum. And I said, you know what? What's really going to make this entire trip is we need to strip down to our clothes, to our bottom clothes. We need to run into the water and actually storm the beaches like 1944. I think she looked at me like, are you serious? We're gonna do this. Okay. And so we storm out into the water. I run back in. I did it. I made it to the beaches of Normandy. And then I looked at her and I said, whoa, how are we gonna get back? Thanks.
That was Issa Brahman, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to share their stories. To listen to these stories, go to arcticentries.com. There, you can also find out more about how to volunteer to tell a story or how to nominate a friend for the Arctic Entries stage.
Our next storyteller on this show is Lukey Tobin, who grew up in Nome, Alaska. Her story takes her far from home to a time when she was a volunteer for the U.S. Peace Corps.
When I was 10 years old, my family went to IHOP. It was a little bit busy, so we put our name into the hostess station and sat down to wait. And we waited, and we waited. We ended up waiting so long that my parents decided to leave. As we were walking out the door, I remember turning to look at my mom to say something. And she had walked up to the hostess station, stood in front of it, and to no one in particular said, if you're going to be a racist, have the guts to be one to my face. My mom was always saying stuff like that. It seemed like every problem, every miscommunication, every slight was attributed to the color of her skin. I really didn't understand that as a kid. I didn't understand it as an adult. I didn't understand it until I spent an hour in Kosovo. In 2008, I left Alaska to go on a stint to the U.S. Peace Corps. I was elated. I was going to be this amazing development volunteer doing all this really cool work. In actuality, I spent 3.5 years trying to mimic this obedient, submissive Muslim woman persona, trying to learn different ways to explain to people why the words they use to describe the color of my skin were hurtful and degrading. At the end of my Peace Corps service, I wanted to go on this trip to find myself again, to reclaim my independence and my strong feminist persona, and decided that I'd travel around Eastern Europe. I convinced my friend Lori to go with me, and that's how we found ourselves on a bus headed into Kosovo. Now I know what you're thinking, and it's true, we both failed US history and world history because we had no idea what we were going toward. We had no idea that in 10 years earlier, that there was this uprising and this war and that this liberation army had tried to ethnically cleanse the country, that if you take this very complex historical situation and bring it down to some very base facts, you could say that the fight was between Muslims and Christians. We had no idea about any of that. What we had heard was there was this statue of Bill Clinton in the center of the capital city, and like good little hippies, we wanted to go see it so we could brag later. As we headed into Pristina, that's what we were thinking about. We were excited about this journey. As I was getting off the bus driver grabbed my arm and said something. I was so tired of always being considered to be a prostitute. I pushed him away and kept on walking. I had no idea that an hour later, I'd be looking to that man for sanctuary. As we walked into the bus station, I remember thinking, am I going to miss this? Am I going to miss how all conversation stops when I walk into a room? How everybody looks at me? I wasn't thinking about the way that I was dressed. I wasn't thinking about the sweater that I'd pulled on earlier that day, the one with the Muslim crescent moon and star screen printed across the front. I wasn't thinking about how I'd covered my head earlier, or how Lori and I had been ribbing each other in Turkish. I definitely wasn't thinking about the shade of my skin and how it was darker than everybody else's in that room. I was thinking about our journey and this rediscovery that we were on and the excitement that I had. And I walked up to the ticket counter and set down my bag and asked the ticket agent, in what I think was pretty awesome Turkish, for 2 tickets to Albania. He was staring at my chest, which was awkward. I tried a few more times to get his attention, but he didn't respond. On the 3rd attempt, he exited the ticket booth, walked around the corner, walked up toward me, reached down, picked up my bag, and walked out the door. I didn't know what the hell was going on. Before I knew it, I was following him out the door, and as the bus station doors swooshed behind me, he dropped my bag and walked back inside. I wish I could tell you that I was thinking of something really smart and snarky and something that was connecting the dots together and making sense of what was happening, but to be quite honest, I really had no effing clue. I really didn't know what was happening. A few minutes later, Lori joined me outside and I turned to look at her and she looked at me and shook her head. Without any real words spoken between us, we had both shrugged on our backpacks and were walking toward a row of taxis in just a few seconds. We started leapfrogging from taxi driver to taxi driver, asking if we could get a ride back to Macedonia. Nobody would help us. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed this group of men had started forming, first one, then a few more, and unlike the people inside the bus station, they weren't being quiet. You know that feeling you get when your armpits are sweating and your hands are clammy and you're starting to get really jittery and you don't know what the heck is going on, but you just know that you need to get out of there, that you need to either fight or flight, and fight is not the option you want to pick. I was trailing behind Lori as she moved on to the next row, which was the buses, and started asking bus driver after bus driver if we could just go where they were going, and they wouldn't help us. As we came to the end of the row, the last bus in the bay was the guy who had brought us there. He had been watching, and as we came closer, he waved us over, ushered us onto the bus, and as I stepped on, he shut and locked the doors behind me. I don't know how long we sat there waiting, but as we pulled out of the bus depot, this memory from when I was 10 years old kept replaying in my head. I didn't really understand my mom as a kid. I didn't understand her as an adult. I didn't understand her until I spent 3.5 years in the Peace Corps and an hour trying to get the hell out of Kosovo.
That was Luki Tobin on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Our theme for this episode is Getaways. We're hearing stories of going undercover, finding paradise, and getting the hell out of Dodge.
Our last storyteller for this show is Yardo Varasiki. Now residing in Anchor Point, he escaped his home country to smoke fish on the Kenai Peninsula. Here's Yardo, live at Arctic Entries in March 2014.
I've never done this before, so it's kind of I'm a little shy about this, but anyway, I'm kind of an ex-Czech, Czechoslovakian, I should say, and I left in 1964. I decided to get the hell out of the Dodge because I got the paperwork for, I had to go to military service for, oh, I guess it was 6.5 years. And so me and my friend, another Yardo, we decided we're gonna basically jump the border. And so we took my friend's motorcycle and we went from, I'm from Karlsbad, Karlovy Vary, by German border. And we went from Germany to Slovakia. And in Bratislava, we were able to get a library books that we were able to get across the border to Hungary. We kind of snuck behind a tour bus that was sitting there. And when they were going through the border, we kind of got on the other side and zipped through. So we were in Hungary. We had no papers. And basically, at that point, we were already kind of a dodging way because if they would have caught us for any reason, we would have got in a deep trouble. And so we stayed in Hungary for about a week. We stayed on a Balaton lake there, met some people there, and then we end up going toward Yugoslavia. We find a map that we were able to get on these dirt roads and actually cross the Yugoslavian border at night, kind of snuck in through, and we were able to cut through a barbed wire and over Garodis Creek, and we had to push the motorcycle for almost 5 miles or so up in the mountains. And so here we are. We are in Yugoslavia, and so we drove to Koper, which is by Italy. It's kind of like a little border town. And we stay there for about a week, kind of scope up the situation, and then we were trying to find somebody to trade us for the motorcycle that we had to be able to get to boat ride to Italy. And all these different characters that we run into, we kind of got scared. You know, we were 18 years old, you don't know much. So we end up deciding that we're gonna swim. So Koper, and then you could look at the other side, and you can see in the distance Trieste. So there's a patrol boat that goes along the beach every hour, and they shine lights on the beach and at night, of course. So we kind of timed it, and we hopped in the water about maybe 9-ish at night, and straight out from the beach. The boat came by. They were between us already and the shore, so they were shining, you know, on the beach. And so we basically just start swimming toward Trieste. You could see it in the distance. There's a lot of lights. It's a big city. And so we swam. We started about 9-ish, and we got there about maybe, 4 or 5 in the morning. And so we are in Italy, and we're the free guys now. We are, you know, so because I was afraid of getting into a, we didn't know, you know, we had no idea what's going on out there in that world. And we thought, well, they're going to get us in a foreign legion and maybe throw us in some military or whatever. So we end up hitchhiking from Trieste to San Marino, which is a little country in Italy itself. And it's about, you know, halfway down in Italy. So we hitchhiked there. It took us probably over a day or so. So we, when we arrived to San Marino, we asked for political asylum. And so it kind of blew everybody's mind because nobody ever asked them for that. It's, you know, they have a couple of governors, and I think the population is probably a couple hundred. And but it was, you know, I thought it was a good idea, but it still turned out that they really took good care of us. They treated us just absolutely wonderful, and then Interpol had to transfer us back to Italian refugee camp, back to Trieste, where we actually started. And we popped into there was a refugee camp in Trieste. It's an old military prison that got converted into a refugee camp. So we stayed there for, got the political asylum there, and then from there they transferred us to Latina, that's by Rome. And we spent there for 8 months in refugee camp. And then from there, we go to Capua. That's by Naples, down south. And that's where we apply for, you know, to go to United States to emigrate. And that took another 8-9 months. So I was there altogether almost a full 2 years before I was able to, you know, get to New York. And we came to New York, and you know, they give you $10, and then they give you a little package with the soap, and a 1 week stay in the hotel. And the next day, they took us to a place. They give you social security, and I got a job same day washing windows, and here I am in Alaska. I've been here for 20 years. And I love it up here, and it was a good choice, you know. It's good to be here, tell you a little bit what I did. It's kind of had to fizz it down a little bit, so it's hopefully you got the hint. No, thank you.
You just heard a live recording from our March 2014 Arctic Entries event at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. That was Yardo Varasiki.
Thanks for tuning in to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you too can tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, Carlisle Watt. Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music, and to the Alaska Humanities Forum for their support. All the proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. More information about this is also available at arcticentries.com.
This year, we're working with the Humanities Forum to hear stories about Anchorage's 100-year history. To nominate a storyteller for this, please connect to us through arcticentries.com. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play?